Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS. We're still here. We're still under lockdown. I think I've eaten Marmite every day for the last 5 weeks. Does that make me weird, Thea?
Why would that make you weird? Do you not do that? Did you not do that before?
Do you know what? It's interesting. It's not that interesting, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have a love of Marmite, but I feel that I'm sort of eating it more in lockdown.
Right. Is that just because you're at home more? With ready access to it.
But I asked people on Twitter actually about a week ago what would their lockdown be sponsored by if it was sponsored by a food stuff. And mine would be Marmite. And quite a few people said Marmite, because I think there is something, the sort of the umami tang of comfort about it that people do crave.
Mm.
But and then some people were saying sort of sweet stuff. It was very stodgy, very carby food generally that people would be sponsored by. Would you be just sponsored by a particularly artisanal brand of pasta?
I mean let's face it, I would be sponsored by pasta. Yeah. I would probably choose to be. Am I allowed to name a brand?
Yeah, of course.
I think I'd like to be sponsored by Rumo pasta, because they're my favorite, but they're increasingly hard to come by.
Oh well, maybe they could sponsor this podcast.
Maybe. Well, putting the word out there.
Yes, exactly. Now, listen, we've got a lot of feedback to get through. And getting emails from listeners and tweets from listeners, it's becoming one of the real joys of lockdown for me. So do keep it coming. We've got a couple of categories I want to talk about. Literary pets.
This is all getting very serious and regimented.
It is. But I knew that people wouldn't let us down on literary pets. So are you ready? Kyle Burris from Kentucky emailed me with a photo of his cat called Shoppen Meower.
I'm sure the full name isn't used all the time. Also, this is a connected point. How many people actually call their pets the name that they originally gave them?
Yeah, well, that's probably true. I think though, what you've got to do is you've got to give it a formal name that can be reduced. So Shoppen Meower, I think, is, you know, you could then call him, I don't know, Shoppy. Maybe. Does that work? I don't know. Anyway, Shoppen Meower is genius. More literary, though, is the cat tweeted in by Emma Burris Jansen called Miss Marple. Great name for a cat. And the cat's apparently a frequent reader of the TLS. She sent us a picture of it sitting on the copy of the paper and says she naturally did take issue with the cover piece on the joyousness of dogs.
That one ended up in the litter tray, I imagine.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah. You know, I promised my kids cats, you know, after lockdown.
Did you mean to do that?
Well, we had to give up our dog Biscuit, as you know, because of the baby.
Yeah.
And so we haven't had a pet for a year. And the next door neighbours have a cat that comes into our house, mainly because we lure it in with food. And everyone's just really keen on cats. And do you know what our preferred name is? It's almost literary.
Go on.
Boudica. but Boo. So I think that works, you see. So Boudica the cat is one of the names. Anyway, we've got some more pet names. John Langridge has a dog called Pynchon. Great literary name. And Laura Freeman, the lovely writer and guest on our podcast, used to babysit for a family that had a King Charles Spaniel called Peeps. Creepy Peeps. There you go. And one more. Alex Diggins has emailed with this brilliant contribution. When I was growing up, my family had a policy of pet names which followed not only the literary canon, but the classical one. We had a much-loved dog called Horace and a couple of cats, Tiberius and Sappho. Recently, those standards have rather slipped, and my mum now lives with two cockapoos called Mabel and Marmite.
Oh, there you go, Marmite.
There we go, it all comes back together. And one more pet, I will shut up in a minute. We've had Beckett named after Samuel, but Geoffrey Boone offers another Beckett. Ours is not is named not for the playwright, but for the quondam archbishop and martyr. He comes complete with hair shirt.
Very good.
And anyone who uses the word quondam in a tweet is all right with me. So anyway, that's the literary pets. Can we do better than that? I like to think we have. So if you're sitting there listening with a literary pet, the bar is set very high. Before we move on, some food reflections. Sabina Zambon emailed with a photo from the aftermath of panic buying in Italy. Do you remember this, Thea? She sent a picture of a supermarket that had been sort of gutted by a horde of hungry people, and they'd left baked beans. And you replied to that email, Thea, with an absolutely astonishing fact. You were once offered the gig of copywriting for Heinz in Italy.
Yeah, it was a weird, one of those weird things, you know, when people approach you on LinkedIn and make you strange offers.
No one's ever done that to me.
Oh, really? No. I left LinkedIn, promptly. <Yeah. laughs> But yeah, I couldn't bring myself to do it.
What would you have to do? Would you have to come up with like cool?
I'm not quite sure. I didn't allow things to get that far. Just felt like something I didn't want to be involved with. But how's this for a coincidence? This morning, I got a press release reporting that according to an online shop catering to British expats, I can't remember what it was called. I think it might have been called Corner Shop or something like that. But baked beans have seen a 44% increase in sales among British expats compared to the same period last year. Crumpets are up 55%. And they break it down by country. So in Italy, apparently, Branston Pickle and McVitie's Ginger Nuts are particularly popular at the moment.
Okay.
I mean, well, I don't know what to do with that information apart from share it.
Well, that's all we can do with information. I can see that, but is that English people? Can you imagine?
Yeah, that's British expats.
Yeah, I can't imagine. Can you imagine nonnas sort of wandering down to the shop and picking up the Branston pickle?
Well, my nonna, of course, being a slightly odd one, she does love McVitie's Ginger Nuts.
There we go.
So I actually sent her some by post around Easter time.
Yeah, I love this stuff. Anyway, you know the drill. Get in touch with your food habits, expat or otherwise, reading habits, literary pets, anything that stimulates you from this podcast. Tweet us at the TLS, at StigAble, at Thea_LeonardDootsie. You can always email me at stig.able@the-tls.co.uk. This bit of the podcast is getting longer and longer, Thea.
It's longer than the podcast itself.
It is, but I do enjoy it. Meanwhile, let me help you subscribe cheaply to the TLS. All you need to do is use this special offer code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. It's the best price anywhere on the internet. 5 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up this week, it might be as easy as ABC, but when did alphabetization become a thing? James Waddell has reviewed a new book on the subject and introduced me to the phrase, it's hard to say, I'm going to give it a go, anti-ABCDarianism. Is that right, Thea?
I think so.
ABCDarianism.
I think I try to flow it all together and make a mess of it. Anti-Abecedarianism?
That's better. Abecedarianism.
It's almost certainly wrong.
Yeah, you're still the pronunciation guru. That's to come. One of my favourite TLS writers, BJ Silcox, has written an essay about her life since coronavirus, living in Western Australia while her husband is in Cairo. And as mask wearing may become part of the new normal, how common is it in Eastern societies and what can that teach us?
What was Samuel Taylor Coleridge railing against when, in 1784, he described information divided into innumerable fragments, scattered like a mirror broken on the ground, presenting instead of one, 1,000 images, but none entire? The answer is not that he had time travelled to the gates of modernism and did not at all like what he saw, but rather that the second edition of the Encyclopaedia Britannica had taken a rather different approach to the organisation of information. The reason Coleridge was so wound up, and I'm afraid my reading just now didn't do justice to his ire, was alphabetization. And he wasn't the only one to take issue. Judith Flanders has treated the surprisingly disorderly history of Abecedarianism, which is easier to write than it is to say, in a book called A Place for Everything. James Waddle reviews it in this week's TLS, and he is here on the line to tell us all about it. Hello, James.
Hello, hi.
Thanks for coming on. So ABCD, etc., is so natural a means of organisation for us now, in Latinate languages at least, that it's kind of difficult to imagine anyone objecting. It seems to us almost the ultimate in logic. But the disapproval goes back far beyond Coleridge. What were the main charges against it?
Yeah, I mean, it's so funny, isn't it, that Coleridge anecdote? I mean, it's so sort of classic Coleridge. It's like, why would you put across your ideas in a simpler form when you can get them across in a deeply complex and arcane way known only to you, which is ultimately flawed and doomed? But it's not as unique to him, as you say, as it might sound. So, you know, really the book is almost more of a history of anti-alphabetical order, or of alternatives to alphabetical order, as much as it's a history of alphabetical order itself. So another character is Abraham France, who's this sort of grammarian poet and lawyer who in the 1580s writes in a kind of similar vein to Coleridge. And he says that if you prefer to have your legal textbooks in alphabetical order, you might as well prefer to eat acorns with hogs than bread with men. So pretty strong condemnation. But I mean, I suppose he was never really that concerned with readability anyway. I mean, he wrote all of his poetry in classical hexameters, which is not really a form that especially cares for clarity of communication. But I mean, the point is that in this respect, at least, France and Coleridge, they're not actually outliers. They're part of a very long tradition of alphabet critique. And I think what that tradition has as a common vein is this sense that alphabetical order is arbitrary, that it defies the divine arrangement of things that has been set before us by God. So obviously in medieval and early modern society, where the power structures of society depend to a large extent on the innate structures of the divinely ordered universe, and when books and written records are part of reifying and reflecting those structures, you know, messing with the order is potentially a, you know, pretty subversive idea. So what that means is that in your, you know, medieval leech books, your medical books, they're arranged with diseases and cures in order a capite ad calcem, from head to heel. Yeah. Scholarly books are ordered sky, then sea, then land, then people, divided into classes and so on. And alphabetical order is quite threatening to all that, because it's essentially arbitrary. You know, it's completely neutral. So if your last name was Adamson and you always come at the start of lists, that's not because you own lots of land, or because you are richer than everyone else, or because you're born before anyone else, all of which would be kind of ordering systems based in meaning. It's just because that happens to be your name. And what this means is that alphabetical order doesn't reflect people's values back at them. And that's something which we find quite useful today, but is quite kind of, you know, threatening to societies historically.
I always tell my children, because I'm able, so I'm always, in school, I was always at the front of the register. I tell my kids, it's good, you should seize the opportunity, because you'll often be asked to do things first. That's great, that you should count yourself lucky that you're an able, because that means you get to do things first, and it means you can show off that you can do them.
And not be judged compared to how other people have done it before.
Exactly, but also I think you have to be a bit more confident if you're at the top. This arbitrariness is exactly right, isn't it? That there's no reason why you'd be called upon first, but you probably will be called upon first more often than not, and that will in some ways shape how you behave a bit. So it does have force, doesn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, that's a point which Flanders actually doesn't actually make so much in the book. But I've just been rereading the Malcolm Gladwell book, Outliers, where he talks about, you know, these kind of unexpected hidden factors which lead some people to become, you know, terribly successful where others aren't. So I don't know, whatever, like a disproportionate number of billionaires have late birthdays, which means they go into the school year below, so they're older than their classmates or whatever. So I wondered if something similar applied to the alphabet. You know, if you're always being called on first in the register, does that have some kind of marginal impact that builds up over time? And sure enough, it turns out that some studies have demonstrated that if you have a name that's closer to the top of the alphabet, you're more likely to get into a better university, to get a better job, and so on. So yeah, maybe the alphabet isn't actually entirely value neutral after all. And as someone with a W surname, oh, yeah, I've clearly been suffering from it all my life.
I'm almost exactly in the middle. Completely mediocre.
Silent prejudice against you, James. Now we should fight back against it. One of the striking things you've said that you say in the piece and the book talks about is that we regard that the sort of handiness of alphabetization, the ease and usefulness of it, as almost intuitive and second nature. But it's striking that for thousands of years since alphabets, that wasn't really seen as an obvious trait, an obvious benefit, was it?
No. I mean, I think actually, in a way, the benefits of alphabetical order for us are the same things which make it, you know, the same qualities which make it potentially a deeply troublesome and problematic organizational system for pre-Enlightenment scholars and clerks, because it doesn't tell you anything about the things or persons which are being sorted. So, you know, it can help you to organize things and it can help you to find things, but it doesn't tell you anything about those things. You know, it doesn't help you to understand them. And obviously, the kind of flip side of that, the plus side, is that you don't need to understand anything about the things being ordered in order to find them or use them. So, you know, if someone tells me to go to a biology library and find a book about dipterology, and the books in the biology library are placed in order of species and subspecies, then, you know, I'm not afraid to admit that I'm probably going to have quite a hard time finding that book. But if the library is arranged in alphabetical order, then it's going to be just as easy for me to find a book about dipterology as it would to find a book about dogs or Darwin or, you know, whatever other biological topics begin with D. So in that sense, it's kind of a magical tool. You know, it's almost as if without it, all of the knowledge that humans have been accumulating over centuries would just sort of be lying in these big stacks, unsifted and unfindable.
But that's what people used to want, wasn't it? I mean, that is that the point that you draw in the end, that there was a time when knowledge was precious and hoarded by people, the church primarily, to say, you know, mysteries, the idea that you had to be granted some sort of special access, and there was a whole bunch of common people who couldn't get that access and shouldn't have that access. So is this sort of democratization of the alphabet, does that kind of coincide with democratization more generally, the thinking that this should be available for everyone?
Yeah, well, that's Flanders, sort of one of her big claims, isn't it, is that she talks about, and I mean, this is actually almost more a point about alphabetical writing systems rather than alphabetical order. So, which is sounds like a fine distinction, but you have alphabetical writing systems for quite a long time before people think about using alphabetical order for anything other than memorizing the alphabet. So alphabetical writing systems are, you know, seem very intuitive to us, and they come to us so naturally. You know, they're probably literally almost the first thing that you learn about as a child that is theoretical and detached from your immediate experiential reality. But despite that, it's actually not that intuitive. So before you have the alphabetic writing systems that we're all familiar with today, which stays amazingly consistent throughout its history, you have logographic writing systems in which every character carries some kind of inherent meaning. So you might have a character for ox, you might have a character for the suffix pre, but each character basically carries some kind of semantic content. But the letters of the alphabet don't carry any semantic content by themselves. They represent sounds without meanings of their own. And Flanders compares this to the invention of money in the 6th century BC, because money and letters in the alphabetical system are both kind of detached, fungible signifiers. And this is a really amazing innovation when you think about it. You know, you go from having these writing systems with thousands of characters that, as you say, are quite jealously guarded often by a priestly or a scholarly elite, to having a system with 25 symbols which can achieve as much conceptual complexity as language itself. So yeah, it is an extraordinary democratizing thing. And I think you know, the fact that the earliest attestations of alphabetical writing systems, which pretty much all come from one place in the western desert of Upper Egypt, they're left by traders and mercenaries. And I think it's instructive that those are the people who are coming up with this, because they need a quick, rough and ready, versatile writing system that gets across what they're trying to say.
And also, I mean, all of this work that had to happen to language itself in order to kind of open the gate in the first place, and then all of the resistance that followed that, when and where and why did it start to catch on as a way of organizing information?
I mean, it takes a long time to emerge, and it definitely becomes a more common system as the 16th and 17th centuries progress. And that's partly because you're operating in this more sort of rationalist post-Enlightenment paradigm, whereby you're a bit less possibly concerned with the divinely ordered world as passed down to us by our intellectual forebears. So that's one reason why it grows in popularity. Although even these big Enlightenment figures, you know, people like Robert Boyle, the natural philosopher, he organizes his notes with this insane combination of streamers, strings, different colors of covers, numerals. He writes little mnemonic poems so that he can remember where everything is. But broadly, the picture is that as you move into this different kind of intellectual paradigm, it becomes more conducive to the system. Also practical reasons. So you have increasingly complex scholarly demands, increasingly complex administrative demands as the state bureaucratizes. So something that Flanders points out is that well into the history of Norman England, it's totally fine for legal assertions to be made by 12 knights turning up and swearing an oath aloud. But as the state begins to rely more on written record, that kind of thing becomes a lot less practical. You need to locate documents, even if you don't know anything about their content or understand what's in them. And as we were talking about before, that's where alphabetical order comes in very handy.
On a final point, we should say that anti-Abbasidinarianism is not entirely a thing of the past.
It must be.
Yeah, well, I mean, interestingly, you know, I talked about Abraham Frantz, the lawyer, and anti-alphabetization probably has one of its real contemporary strongholds now in the legal world. So there's still some Supreme Court judges who say that alphabetized legal textbooks, you know, reduce legal principles to just a floating linguistic phenomena. But there's also kind of more practical complaints about it. So using one alphabet for everything does cause problems in an increasingly globalized society. So there's one story that Flanders mentions in the book where the International Olympic Committee has these guidelines which say that countries should enter opening ceremonies in alphabetical order. But obviously, if the Olympics is being hosted in a country that doesn't use the Roman alphabet, that causes problems. So, you know, at the Seoul Games in 1988, you had Ghana entering first, followed by Gabon, because Ga is the first syllable of the Korean syllabary, which meant that you had Western TV networks kind of tearing their hair out, completely frazzled, trying to work out where they should put their ad breaks so that they wouldn't have an advert on top of their own country's appearance.
It's a good lesson generally, that, though, isn't it? Because we always assume that our alphabet, our system, is the system, and the world has to shape itself around whatever system we've got. And it's probably quite a useful lesson to remember that different organisational principles exist in different parts of the world who don't regard the centre of the earth to be London or Britain.
Right, yeah, especially because, you know, we all use writing technologies that are internationally produced, and, you know, Western keyboards are potentially problematic if you're trying to use Chinese characters, for example. I mean, it's made easier now with pinyin and predictive text to write Chinese characters with Western keyboards. But nevertheless, it's like an imperfect solution. So yeah, even if it seems neutral to us, it might not seem that way in the rest of the world.
Yeah. This is completely irrelevant, but I'm going to say it anyway. There was a time a couple of years ago when the whole British press were trying to get into the White House for a briefing. And because Britain does its date order different to America, everyone's birth dates on their passports were different to the birth dates that they were giving to the people on the at the door of the White House, and the press couldn't get in. because they're just like, why are you saying your birthday's in September when it's clearly in November? And they're like, no, we put the day, obviously we make sense. And actually, America is an outlier. They go month, day, year, and obviously most countries do day, month, year. But it's things like that that it is a useful thing to think about, how what we regard as just incontrovertible, neutral things are not neutral.
It's good to be tripped up sometimes.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, it's that story just kind of illustrates once again that, you know, there's no, it's like Borges says, that there's no classification of the universe that is not arbitrary and conjectural. But nevertheless, you know, the impossibility of trying to understand the design of the universe and its infinite complexity doesn't mean that we're not gonna come up with these flawed systems anyway, even though we're kind of aware that they're provisional and might mean that you can't get into the White House interview that you're trying to get into.
Indeed, it's something we try to do almost every week on this podcast, I would say. Well, not get into the White House.
I don't think we'd be welcome in the White House there, but also I feel that this piece actually does exactly the thing I want to happen, is that you think, oh, ABC, I understand that, and of course I don't, we don't, no one does properly, and now you've given us a lesson in it. So James, we're very grateful for that. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Cheers.
Thank you. Bye.
I love that. I love also, Thea, the fact that we end up with Borges as well. I felt it. We needed him to pop.
I felt it was coming.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you if people send you the same generic conversation starters they message everyone else? Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Here's how some people end up writing for the TLS. Sometimes they send an email with some ideas or published articles. We read it and think this person really has something. We don't always do it, but it's really important to us that we discover writers who may go on to become brilliant contributors to the TLS. Well, that happened with BJ Silcox, who sent me her tremendous takedown of Jermaine Greer in The Australian. And now she reviews all sorts for us all the time, which makes me very happy indeed. Anyway, BJ is Australian, but until recently lived in Cairo with her diplomat husband. And while he stayed there, when the coronavirus struck, her weak lungs sent her home to WA. She's written a love letter of sorts from there and is on the line with us now. BJ, hello.
Hello.
Firstly, before we talk about your lovely piece, paint the scene for us. What's it like there in Western Australia?
Well, I'm at the southernmost tip of Western Australia, right down the bottom in a little town called Albany. And for readers who are lovers of Australian literature, it's the hometown of Tim Winton, our much beloved Australian fiction writer. It is, yes. So anyone who has loved Breath or some of his early novels or Island Home, that beautiful book he wrote about the Australian landscape, will know Albany from the page. But that is where I'm based at the moment, on the banks of the Lower King River. And it's a beautiful spot. If you have to pick a spot to be quarantined, I highly recommend it.
And how free are you to go out, get to the beach and to wander around? How strict is your quarantine?
It's just starting to ease off. So we're just starting to see the region come back to life, although Western Australia locked its regions down, so you weren't able to travel from region to region. And I think that's had a lot to do with kind of keeping it very much in a couple of isolated places. So we were spared a lot of coronavirus. I think we had only 9 active cases in the region that we were in, and they were all identified. So we're at that point now where restrictions are starting to ease off, but that's that horrible feeling of both a sense of incipient freedom and then that, are we being complacent? Are we starting to get out too early? And there's that very awkward feeling of life isn't ever going to return to what we know it to be, but at the same time there's an opportunity for it to bloom again, and where do we sit in that, and how do we engage with the world in a place in an isolated place in the most isolated state in an isolated nation? So it's a very strange feeling.
And from where we are, Australia, and I mean not so much as New Zealand perhaps, but still in the same breath, is being reported as a success story in terms of dealing with COVID. Does it feel like that there? Do you feel like you're in a country that's got a grip on things, that is handling things well?
I think it certainly feels like we're in control of how bad the virus is getting, but certainly the economic wallop is coming. And that's the great fear now. I think it's shifted from a sense that we're going to be hit with large swathes of the virus infecting people, and moving towards that sense of our economy, our way of life is going to be irrevocably changed. And how do we cope with that? It looks like our second airline, we only have 2 major airline carriers, has gone into administration in the last week. It's clear the economic impact is going to be mighty and large and long. And so how do we, as a country which is quite isolated from the global economy, how do we start to rebuild that? What does a new normal look like? So I think there's a kind of a shift in where the focus is.
And as well, I mean, Australia talk about things coming in threes. There was the crisis of the fires, coronavirus crisis, and now you're talking about an oncoming economic crisis.
And we're living them simultaneously. I'm very close to the Stirling Ranges, which was hit by not the East Coast bushfires, we're on the West Coast, but there were some horrific bushfires here. And in my first week out of quarantine, my parents drove me for a bushwalk in some of the bushfire damaged zone. And I've seen bushfire damaged bush before, but I've never seen annihilation like this. And it is utter annihilation. You're walking in rubble of a bush that was there. And they say it'll be about 100 years before it is able, if it is at all able, to recover to what it was before. I've never seen the kind of incendiary damage that these bushfires had. And it feels like walking in a forest of ghosts. The regrowth is very small. There were skeletons of kangaroos and the mammals that couldn't get away, kind of bleached and charcoaled out. The whole place was absolutely thick with flies and ants that were kind of crawling over the dead. It was an extraordinary scene, and it happened months ago, and it still has that incredible wretch to it, the smoke of it. So these are very much overlaid across one another, and the damage of that, I think, for want of a better word, cyclically to the country, that anchors so much of who it is and what it cares about in landscape and who we are as people in the iconic sense of an Australian landscape. It's It's devastating, but it's had a sense of a kind of collective, incoherent grief. I think we know that we've lost something that matters incredibly to us, but the scope of that grief is huge and hard to pin.
You start your piece talking about some of the local fauna, the millipedes that surround you. Tell us about them.
Well, yeah, so I flew from Egypt to Australia and landed in my parents have a kind of converted shed that they've made into this wonderful quarantine palace for me. And I feel like a kind of indiscreet ingrate of a daughter for immediately writing about the fact that it was infested with insects. There's been a huge sort of infestation of millipedes this year. They're Portuguese millipedes and they're introduced species that don't belong in Australia. And as I said in my piece, they're a nuisance rather than a menace, but they're everywhere. And my first few nights here sort of a bit struck with jet lag and the kind of heartbreak of the decision I just made and the indefiniteness of the separation. Every night you could hear them on the floor sort of dropping from the walls, and I started to kind of collect them, these millipedes that had come inside, drawn in by the light of my cell phone and my laptop and my bedside light. And the whole floor was alive with these introduced species, but also a kind of plague within a plague. And then I sort of stumbled over this incredibly rich, stinking metaphor. And it got me kind of the storyteller in my brain went nuts and thought, oh, this is brilliant. I have something to write about, as they were curling into my bed sheets and over my feet. Yeah, there's nothing more humbling than finding a millipede in your underpants. So I knew I had to write about it, but for what story? And that's what I grapple with in the piece that I've had the privilege to write for the TLS, is how do you take a decision like the decision I made to indefinitely leave my husband in Egypt? How do you take that decision and make a story out of it? How will any of us take the stories that we have out of COVID and turn them into the narratives that we tell to others and to our children and to history? And stories are our memory makers and our history makers, and the kind of weight of that is all caught up for me in this very potent metaphor that I didn't quite know what to do with.
And you make the point very movingly in your piece that, you know, we all tell stories about what this has been like, and we will tell stories. But at the moment, you don't know how this story is going to end. You've been separated from your husband. He's in Cairo, which is, like everywhere in the world, a dangerous place to be. You're back home in a shed in your parents' place in Western Australia. You don't know how long you're going to be separated. You don't know how this story is going to end.
No, I don't. And I think for me that, and for many other people, I think the terror of COVID is that it's indefiniteness, it's uncertainty. It's how much it plays with our very human desire for endings, for closure, for certainty. And I don't have an ending to that story. And I can imagine a number of them, and some of them are terrifying and some of them are beautiful. And it's hard not to be kept awake at night wondering how this part of my marriage will play out and how this will play out for all of us. And it had me thinking about, well, how do you start to tell the beginning of a story where you don't know what the end is? What does it mean to start to put those pieces in place to, as I write in my piece, to anoint the heroes and the villains, and to think about the lessons we will learn and won't learn and what we'll remember and forget?
What do you most miss about your husband? He might listen to this, actually. He'll be in Cairo. He might listen to this podcast. What's the one little thing you most miss about him?
Oh, it's going to make him so uncomfortable to say it. It's brilliant.
say it.
I miss being held. Aww. I miss being held, which will make him, he will know that that's true, and it will make him very uncomfortable because he's an incredibly private person, but I miss being held. And I also miss, he has an extraordinary mind, and we have loved each other for 22 years. I met him in the very first week of university. He was the first friendship that I had at university. And he's, in a sense, I moved my entire life, and he's my oldest friend. And that's a really great way to hold on to your best friend, is to marry them so they have to stay with you. And so he has this extraordinary mind, and ours spark off one another. And I feel like 22 years ago, I started a conversation that I'm still having. And I miss being in the same room to bounce that conversation back and forth with each other, to pull the world apart in the way that only he can.
And what was it like in Cairo, in Egypt? Because, you know, I think this virus, the feeling of it is, I mean, in some ways it's the same in every city, in every town, in every country. And yet I suspect it probably is experienced differently. How did it feel as the sort of rumours swirled in a city like Cairo?
Cairo is such a guarded place in many ways that it was an interesting time to be there, that there was certainly what we knew about it was that COVID was definitely in Luxor with the tourist boats, but we didn't know much more about it. And there was this kind of strangely wrenched in between place, between the kind of incipient panic of what was coming, this feeling that this wave was coming, but then also life was incredibly normal at the point at which we decided to go. And so that feeling, that kind of eye of a storm feeling, where you know that something is about to hit, but you don't know the shape of it, and yet you're still buying flowers on the street and going and walking. You know, I had a friend visiting who was actually on her Cairo dream holiday, which turned out to be rather not what she was expecting. But we were still sightseeing together and pointing out the old buildings and the island in Zamalek, where I live. And it all felt incredibly normal, but in an incredibly artificial way. Yeah. So it was a strange unbelonging.
I feel it would be a shame if we didn't take this opportunity to learn something about the biosignature emitter diagram.
As I say in my piece, misinformation blooms everywhere. And as I was getting ready to leave, there was this kind of flurry of people trying to make sense of what was about to come. And one of it was a community centre where I teach creative writing was sending us homeopathic remedies that would cure the coronavirus. And then also plans to print off the biosignature emitter diagram, which was a PDF of a very set of intentional squiggles with a space in the middle where you would put your photograph, and you would print it and put your photo in the middle because it carried all of your essential energy. And if you put it on the wall, the lines and squiggles would sort of grasp all of the energy that was in the air and push it towards you somehow and create a kind of elemental force field that would protect me from the virus and 5G as long as I kept it free of dust.
Well, it sounds so obvious when you say it.
It does, but I kind of received this on the day that I left and thought, how do I process how to think about this?
Bija, have you had COVID, do you think?
No.
Well, there you go then. I'm no scientist, but I believe that constitutes proof that that works.
But I also did not print it and did not put my face in the middle of it.
Oh God. Oh no, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't prove anything. Maybe it proves nothing.
We'll never know now.
Yeah, I was too blithe with my safety. I was too busy hopping on a plane to find a photograph and print the biosignature emitter diagram.
That 5G, the whole 5G controversy has been one of those things that I know as someone interested in the news, I should have taken more interest in, but I just haven't quite clicked that. What is it? There's this conspiracy theory, isn't it, that some people think this whole virus is faked in order to sell 5G? Is that a thing? Is that the controversy?
Well, I believe that it was 5G is causing the virus.
I think there's probably an argument that the coronavirus, and there's probably a piece to be written about this somewhere, that brings out both the best and the worst in people.
Right? As does any crisis, yeah.
Yeah, it's probably true. BJ, you talk about plague literature and how you don't really want to read it, which I do understand. We've covered a lot of plague literature in one way or other in the TLS over the last couple of weeks.
Well, in fact, I reviewed two plague pieces for you earlier, at the end of last year. Yes, yeah, ironically enough.
It's not something I want to turn to, although we've got a lovely piece coming up on sort of Defoe's A Journal of the Plague Year. And people are, I think, interested in it. But one of the things we are doing a lot on this podcast is talking about what we're reading and watching in lockdown. So if it's not plague literature, what's distracted you, BJ, over the last couple of
weeks? Well, I did have grand plans, as many people do, that this was going to be the time that I sat down and faced the shelf of constant reproach, which is all the books that have been sitting there glaring at me that I pretend to read at dinner parties. And one of them was going to be Middlemarch. But there's just too many Manners and too many Vickers. And so I have not, in fact, been reading Middlemarch. I've been catching up. We have a number of valiant independent bookstores in Australia that are staying open. One in Albany here that that stayed open, and then a couple that in there's one in the Avid Reader bookstore in Queensland that have been posting books out to people. So I've been catching up on all the amazing Australian literature that's come out that I missed the chance to get my mitts on when I was in Cairo. So that's been really exciting to sort of catch up with something that I sort of felt distant from.
And any recommendations?
Eleanor Savage, Blueberries. If I'm going to give you one, that's the one.
Well, sold.
I love a good recommendation. BJ, look after yourself. I know you're going to see your husband soon. I know he'll be uncomfortable now about you talking about him, but that's always a service I like to provide. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, and thank you for having me. It's been really wonderful to talk.
My mother-in-law, Jeanette, a very fine woman, has been spending some of her lockdown time making masks for all the family out of old T-shirts and spare bits of elastic, the idea being that when we all go back to school and work, we will have some protection. And I have to say, we've been eyeing them nervously. Wearing a mask feels even proleptically stifling, awkward, a bit creepy. But that may just be a social construct of ours. Jordan Sand this week ponders the difference between East and West when it comes to mask wearing, contrasting the dithering that happens in, say, his native America with the sea of surgical masks visible in Tokyo, where he resides for part of the year. Why the split and when did it happen? Jordan is with us to consider the matter further. Jordan, hello.
Hello.
Mask wearing as a kind of issue of coronavirus is sort of growing day by day in Britain, and I think in the US probably as well. Are you surprised that it's kind of been the subject of so much controversy and dispute and concern? Because from your account, it feels like a relatively straightforward response to a pandemic.
I guess it does feel to me fairly straightforward. I don't know that I'm so surprised that some people feel resistance to wearing something they had not worn before, and there are social implications to it. I was surprised that it would rise to the level of something that had to be pronounced upon by institutions like the WHO and the CDC here, and equally surprised in a way that so many of us, and I have to include myself here, waited for those pronouncements before doing something.
Yeah. I actually find that day by day in Britain, at least, if you go out onto the street, you see more and more masks. It feels like from a very, very low base, it's beginning to become normal, if not quite normal yet.
Yes, it's the same in the supermarket in my neighborhood. I'm sure most of the people I see are wearing them for the first time, and many of them are improvising them. But they've become quite normal just in the course of a few weeks.
I wonder if in the West, to generalize massively here, we find it harder to accept that we might be vectors of disease. We take it as some kind of indictment on ourselves and our way of life.
I suppose that's possible. You know, I really can't say too much about the psychological sort of peculiarities of different nations with regard to infection there, but I'm struck more that it's seen as somehow threatening and alienating, and one thinks of the veil in France, the idea that somebody would cover themselves is itself looked frowned upon, I guess. But I don't know, yeah.
Your expertise is in Japanese history. Tell us about Japan and its history of mask wearing, because it's become relatively an acceptable part of culture there, hasn't it?
Yeah, a custom, really. I mean, it's very, very widespread today in the flu period, and I mean, in the cold months of the winter, and also through when the pollens are at their most active in the spring. So you see them through a good portion of the year. And it seems to go back quite a ways. The most historians date the widespread mask wearing in Japan, as in many other countries, to the flu pandemic of 1918. Although there does seem to have been an earlier efflorescence of mask wearing in Manchuria during a pneumonic plague outbreak in 1910-11. But in any case, in Japan, the first instance of the mass of ordinary civilians wearing masks seems to be in the 1918 flu epidemic. And what's interesting is that then it stuck. Not everybody wore them all the time. It seems to have ebbed and flowed subsequently, but it was popular. And I suspect that that's because that was a time when new trends coming from the West were eagerly lapped up in Japan, and and particularly if they had the air of modern science. And so there was little resistance. And subsequently, even without any encouragement from the authorities, Japanese would wear them frequently in flu season. And as I said, more recently in hay fever season.
You talk, though, in the piece about a kind of a Japanese attunement to the problem of contagion. You've got a great quote from 1808. Air is strong. People do not know its strength. Air is to humans what water is to fish. The idea that air is a medium that can carry things. It has a sort of certain solidity to it. Is that a cultural touch point of Japan, do you think, the sort of the awareness of the danger of the air?
Well, no, you know, I think, and I reading scholars in the history of medicine, which is not my actual area of expertise, but I think that the more natural way to understand this is that contagion in some form has been understood intuitively very widely by people throughout the world and for centuries or millennia, and that doctors in some European and American doctors were resistant to the idea because the terms in which it was usually understood were of malevolent spirits or curses, and so it became associated in the West with superstition. What's interesting is the long progress towards the eventual, of course, the discovery of bacteria and then viruses under the microscope, of understanding what air is and what is carried in it. And that quotation that I cited is from a very interesting moment because this is a Japanese scholar in a period in which the shogun's government had closed off all trade and diplomacy with Europe, with the exception of a small Dutch outpost in the port of Nagasaki. And Japanese scholars were getting all of their information about developments in science in Europe through books provided to them by the Dutch. Everything connected with modern science coming from Europe was referred to as Dutch studies. And here was this scholar of Dutch studies who was reading materials that he had received from the Dutch or that had circulated from that trading post and understanding that it had been demonstrated experimentally that air was a substance. It was made of molecules and it had mass and density. And looking for commonplace ways to convey this to a general audience in Japan. And so he makes the comparison. Air is to humans what water is to fish. It's not just a void that we move through. We know that water has mass and density, and yet fish inhabit it. And similarly, we inhabit the air, but at the same time, air it has substance to it, and that substance passes into our bodies as well. And so I think this is a process of sort of trying to understand in empirical terms something that many people had perhaps intuited, but had only been able to articulate in terms of the supernatural.
And then masks play a role sort of almost symbolically, don't they? Because they separate people. They may even actually at some point in culture have demonstrated people having medical training, so actually being the opposite of superstition, Jordan, the sense that if you're wearing a mask, you may be marking yourself up as someone scientific.
Well, of course. I mean, I think particularly the, you know, the gauze or the white surgical mask that seems to come into use among medical professionals at the late 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, perhaps, it does mark them apart. And I think that persists to some extent even today. And so that association with hygiene and the power of medical authority makes a mask a mask, that is, it's a sort of symbolic extension of the human face that does more than simply block out some particles that might carry infection.
You make an interesting point about the gender split when it comes to masks. Again, talk about blocking something out.
Yes. So, well, I mean, in Japan, the gender split when it comes to everything, the gender differences are very pronounced and expressed in Japan. And the gender split that I talk about was really just a personal observation confirmed by a little bit of looking around online, that it seems a lot more women wear them than men in public. And I had always suspected this had as much to do with a sort of a sense of privacy in the way they were choosing to present themselves in public as it did to do with health concern. And I think it's a mix of both of those things. And this also is not at all a timeless national tradition. It seems to be something that has emerged as a custom among women in the past couple of decades.
You mentioned also the aesthetics of masks. That I thought that was that's a good point. That not only are they a necessary thing, that they become part of the way we fight against a pandemic, but is there a question that they can be rather beautiful? They can be quite daring. They can work with an outfit. That there's a whole potential for the aesthetics of masks, which we've clearly not got to yet in this country. But once you establish them as normal, you can then presumably adorn them in some ways as well.
Well, I mean, that seems to be ongoing right now as people are at home sewing handmade masks, right, as you mentioned, and becoming inventive and interesting. You know, there are always potential whenever you work with fabric and you're going to apply it to your body. So I think we're at the very dawn of the mask fashion world's sort of emerging potential. But in broader terms, there is something there about the choice of a mask. And I've seen recently, I don't know if this is, I have this impression it's coming out of Taiwan, but I don't know, the black masks that make you look like Darth Vader. Not so popular in Japan, but I've seen quite a lot of other Asians wearing them. And that's definitely an aesthetic choice.
And I suspect, and again, if we talk about the Western influence in this whole mask-wearing thing, if you go back far enough, I suspect it's only a matter of time before the whole commedia dell'arte character comes into play with a nose case and, you know, a long cloak and a wide-rimmed hat. I mean, surely that's due a comeback.
Or the V for Vengeance. They think people start wearing the V for Vengeance mask, won't they, as well?
The potentials are the possibilities are limitless. But I do think that precisely the sorts of things you're imagining are why a lot of people have resisted it, too.
Because
a mask does things to your face.
Jordan San, thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to speak with you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to BJ Silcox, Jordan Sand and James Waddle. Make sure you're subscribing to the TLS. We do need your support. And this week is a beautiful issue. We do a special on graphic novels, including an extract from Slaughterhouse-5, plus the cat-killing Czech phenomenon Bohemil Hrabal, How to Teach Remotely, The Tale of Calamity Jane, and more. Next week, we have a life writing issue, so think about all the ways to tell a life story. And of course, Thea, you're going to be a published author in that very medium as well, so you're an expert.
Almost certainly.
Exactly. Well, you'll find out how expert if you tune in. Until next time, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.